Hello, and welcome to this discussion of brand new book, Big Mother, with its author, Jason Horsley. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hello, Connor.
This book is slightly more esoteric than some of our audience may be used to. It was, especially from reading the blurb, I felt like it was almost something that I was... It felt like it was made for me. I mean, you're combining technology, demonology, skepticism of the state, gender issues, serial killing, all into one big package. And so I just wondered if, for people who aren't necessarily familiar with your career history, what was the impetus of this book? What gave you the inspiration to start it? How did it grow?
Right. Well, the first thing that came to mind there was, I don't know if you managed to read Big Mother add-on I sent you in an email, but what happened when I was reading it prior to coming to London for the launch was that I realized, I felt, having reading it all the way through, that I had actually left out something really crucial, which had to do with really making clear what the correlation between all of the subject matter that's covered in the book and this idea of a crypto matriarchy or a gynocracy. First of all, that. And second of all, my own mother. Because generally in my books, I do include autobiographical material because I think it's vital and essential to keep it grounded for myself, but also for the reader. And in Prison and Infinity, for example, even though it's about Whitley Strieber and alien abduction and social engineering and trauma genesis and all these, again, big picture subjects, I did include stuff about my father because there is a lot of stuff around the Oedipus complex and things. And somehow I left out my mother. This is a long way around to answering your question. And I felt that that itself illustrated something because it's the crypto matriarchy, like the influence of the mother on serial killers or social engineers, powerful male figures in society is hidden, just as it is in Psycho, the movie Psycho. And so somehow something in me had prevented me from actually including that, even though I felt it was vital. So, and I mention all that because in a way, and I consider Big Mother optimistically, I consider it the last book I will ever write about hell, quote unquote, or you can take the quotes off if you want, like if you're a Christian out there. To me, hell is the hell that we can see is hell on earth. There might be some metaphysical realm where there's some correspondence, but certainly, you know, the society that we've co-created over generations, to me, it's more than metaphorical to call it hell. Anyway, so I've been writing this series of books since 2014, roughly, with Seen and Not Seen, that are an attempt to uncover the true nature of our society by looking closely at society, but also looking closely at myself and kind of mirroring the two. Like I can use society as a mirror for my own psychological disformation, but also if I look at my psyche, I can then... You can't really look at your psyche, but if I look at my own patterns of neurotic behavior and my own, get a sense of my own traumatized soul and body, then I get a really felt, direct sense of what society is doing to us because it did it to me personally. So there's this series of books that I call Mapping Hell, and I think Big Mother is the last one. I hope it is. I'm sure it is. So it makes perfect sense. It is Big Mother. It's not about my mother because, as I say, I left her out, but implicitly it is because I am an example of the complexes that I'm writing about there. Obviously, I'm not Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or Ted Bundy or Sam Harris are some of the examples I have in there.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I can look at myself and I've got a much closer, more intimate relationship with those pathologies within myself. So the point I'm making is that I've been trying to uncover this secret of my own maternal enmeshment or maternal psychic bondage for this whole process of writing. That's kind of the thing I'm trying to resolve.
Well, it's useful to disentangle that a little bit because I find it interesting that you said that there's almost a psychic blockage there of you not going as far as you could with standpoint epistemology, because there's a totalitarian maternal influence that seems to loom over culture. It's like the Jungian archetype of the devouring mother.
Yeah.
There's something that Jordan Peterson and Mary Harrington and that have spoken about in infesting institutions. But also there's a kind of vacancy behind it, as if that is not the true motivating force. It's not that the gynocracy is the end goal. It's the longhouse at the center of a broader global village. And that this is something that you were focusing on in there, is what is the animating principle that whether it's in quotations hell or whether it is the demons really in the wires that is pushing through all of these forces that are disembodying us from time, from place, from a sense of psychological wellness, with everything from transgenderism to serial killers. What is the spirit that's behind this looming sense of a big mother rather than a big brother? And that's what I found really interesting. So that's probably a better place to go then. Why big mother and not big brother?
Right.
Because obviously the pun is in the title, and most people, especially when they're critiquing dystopias, they immediately fall back on 1984 and they think of the big paternalistic state.
Yeah.
Why is it a big maternalistic state?
Yeah, well, I mean, why am I writing about it? I mean, the answer is because it is, right? Mm. Okay, people don't necessarily see it, but you do, and hopefully, presumably, many people who are going to watch this do see it. They do have it. So it's become more visible that there is the totalitarianism we're under is more of a female totalitarianism. It's a overprotective, overcaring state to an extreme, to a pathological degree. And a lot of the protective, caring, agendas or, whatever we're going to call them, they just do seem to be wolf in sheep's clothing. They do just pretext to control us. But nonetheless, there is a consistency behind the sort of rationale. And it is true, I think, indisputably true, that the kind of Orwellian state that we're living in now, 80 years after he wrote 1984, it doesn't look like a jackboot, you know, on a human face forever. It looks more like a needle in your arm that's saying, trust me, I'm a doctor, right? This is for your own good. And there isn't this obvious oppressive presence. And big part of this is what we've seen, or I feel I've seen, is that people have been conditioned to police each other. So there's this sort of soft totalitarianism again, and whereby the iron boot doesn't have to show itself, or the iron hand, because everybody's been conditioned to keep each other in line, so that draconian presence doesn't have to show itself. I think I lost the thread there.
But you're correct. And I think this is what Jonathan Haidt's written about quite a lot, as well as numerous other psychologists. And that is that female competition mechanisms are more covert, and therefore if you're going to have a more female-centric totalitarian society in temperament, you're going to outsource the enforcement costs of behavior policing to social shame and henpecking, and it's going to be more concerned with the egalitarianism of how you feel than the hierarchical arrangement of there's a party class and the pleb class. Like it's a softer but more insidious form of totalitarianism than the Stalinism that commands you clap for the dear leader, for example. And that might be why it's more successful. That's why it's leaked everywhere, because we can't really see it as much. You can feel it, though. You can definitely feel it.
Yeah, yeah. And I was thinking about this, or talking about this recently, that this is very theoretical, but it's almost as if the hardcore fascism that we know historically now, Stalinism and Hitlerism, you could say that they were tested, would they were. But you could also say that part of the testing of those kinds of totalitarianism was a way of priming us as collectively to think we know what fascism looks like. And so then we can, it's like we expect it to come from the right, And so we're just looking at the right for the jackboots. But no, they've already tried that. It didn't work. And part of trying it, maybe, and maybe knowing it wouldn't work, or maybe not, but whatever, is, okay, now we can definitely come from the other side, because this is a collective psychic imprint. This is the thing to avoid, right? Is fascism. Mm. And it's coming from over there, right? So everybody's looking over there. So it comes from the left, right? That's, I mean, I think that's indisputable, whether it was planned in advance or not. And to bring it back to the mother-brother thing, if I can, I think there is a parallel in this. And certainly in our culture, there's an enormous tendency to blame the male, the toxic masculinity, and to look at abusive fathers or absent fathers, although not so much that, because generally there's a view, well, it doesn't matter if he's absent, because you don't need a father anyway. There's a big clue in that's become culturally accepted, that a father is expendable. But either way, there is a tendency to identify the problem in terms of bad parenting with the father rather than with the mother. And obviously the cliche, I think it's obvious, of a bad father is, again, it's written much larger. Like, what does a bad mother look like? Mm. It's much subtler and more insidious, the harm that bad mothering can do to a psyche in particular. You know, I'm focusing on male psyche for reasons maybe we'll get into. It's much more invisible and therefore more insidious. But the effects are much deeper for that very reason.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the institutionalization of care. This is something that I think some of the more reactionary women that are looking at modernity and going, well, hang on, we've technicalized everything, up until and including the female body, with birth control, with abortion, with surrogacy, with daycare. What you've done is you've extricated the father from the home, and now you've extricated the children from the home, but it's not that you've disconnected them from a mothering influence. You've pathologized the mothering influence and then stuck it in a baby factory, essentially. And so you've now got a collective societal swaddling that is impeding their development while also giving them a maladaptive connection to the state, to its institutions, to its poorly paid representatives in daycare and schooling and things like that, which have very maternal instincts. They're almost ubiquitously populated by women. But the children, they're being reared in a maternal way, but it's that Oedipal mother rather than the comforting mother. So father's entirely gone. Mother has been pathologized, institutionalized, and rolled out totally. And that's what's creating the kinds of people that want to go out and riot in the street and tear down the civilization, because they don't really feel connected to it.
Yeah, well, that's like a tantrum, I think, in this analogy we're making, because, I mean, one fairly simple way perhaps to illustrate the big mother state as it's evolved is, because we're in Britain, you know, the care system, social support system, that doesn't foster autonomy and independence and self-sufficiency. And so if you think of that in the microcosm of parenting, a mother coddles the child, keeps it safe, keeps it warm, whereas the father at a certain point comes to intervene and to take the child outside of the mother's influence and to teach it to stand on its own two feet. That's the father's role. And so I think we could see that the state, if we're going to call it that, but the big mother state, for simplicity's sake, that's one of the ways it's evident, is it hasn't been doing this. It hasn't been motivating and driving. And I'm talking particularly about men, because it's complicated, because of course women have been more and more encouraged, quote, or manipulated to become autonomous and independent, even though they're in the same system of care. And obviously single mothers have been supported, so that also, you know, increases the chances that fathers will be made obsolete. So there are a lot of nuances. There's a danger of oversimplifying, but the main point I did want to make was just this, that autonomy isn't fostered by this the state, the care state, whatever you want to call it, the nanny state. And that's intentional, is my view. Like I, Vice of Kings that I wrote a few years ago was specifically about the Fabian Society and the formation of the Labour Party and the principles behind the Fabian Society. And, that it, it's not, it wasn't, I don't think it was a matter of not, of lack of, far seeing, that a social care state, would actually reduce people's self-sufficiency, that it backfired. No, I think it was mapped out in advance. So what do you have when people have not been allowed to grow up because they've been over-mothered, both literally in their childhood and figuratively, symbolically, as we're talking about in society, you have people who didn't grow up, so they're infantilized. And you see that very easy examples in terms of we live in an entertainment state. I mean, this is in Orwell, it's also in Brave New World. People are basically constantly given all the kinds of distraction and entertainment they could ever want to death. I mean, amusing themselves to death in the Postman phrase. And what happens there? Well, a number of things happen. There's certainly generally impotency is going to be a result, figuratively or literally, for men specifically. But impotency doesn't, there's going to be rage behind that. Right? Impotency, a feeling of powerlessness and not being able to really identify what's oppressing them, is going to lead to this kind of rage without an object. So I think that there's bits to fill in there, but I think you could correlate that to what you were also referring to as this kind of inchoate anger against the patriarchy, quote unquote, or the absent father. But it's strangely been reversed because there's this idea that there's this oppressive father or this oppressive male. But it's not really obvious. As I say, back in the days of Hitler or Stalin, it was obvious. But now, where is he? Well, it was probably why Donald Trump was such a resonator for that kind of rage, even though he didn't really fit that. He didn't goose step. He didn't seem like a totalitarian. He seemed more like a clown. But just the fact that he was kind of ugly and unlikable enough, I think he became an attractor for those projections of, the imagined oppressive father.
Well, you're seeing these sort of totems like Trump, or I was going to connect what you were saying about essentially male impotency leading to rage. The kind of the African proverb almost of the child that isn't allowed around the campfire will come back to the village and burn it down to feel its warmth. These are totems that the establishment, that the either useful idiots or accelerants of this regime latch onto and try to play whack-a-mole with, because they can see their project having momentary interruptions. They hope it's momentary because they believe in sort of long arc of progress towards what they think is a utopia. We can get onto whether or not that's possible later. But they see this manifestation, this as an aberration, but it's actually the consequence of what they've been trying to do. And if you take fathers out of the home, you make intimacy and sexuality and an on-demand entertainment system, you foster a physical dependency on this, you make it so that men, some men, feel that they can't escape it, can't have relationships, and their body is turning against them because they feel dependent on it, then you're going to get the kind of impotent rage that they want to say, oh, there's going to be an incel mass shooter behind every keyboard. And that justifies, again, it perpetuates the surveillance state stepping in and re-educating men and policing online speech. And so it has that ratcheting effect up to exactly what they want, to smack down the dissidents. So it's always like a self-confirming loop there, which I find quite interesting, because that's the kind of thing you were hitting on when you were talking about serial killers later in the book. I found the connection fascinating because I don't think anyone else has really pulled on this thread. And that is that the role of the serial killer in the 70s was both a consequence of technological development and also an excuse for an expansion of the surveillance state.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
I don't mind if I can find a way in, because obviously that you've just introduced the whole thing. And but interesting enough, I mean, just as a lead-in, when I reread Big Mother just recently, as I said earlier, I sort of stumbled over those chapters and I thought, gosh, is this going to just alienate the reader? Because actually, before that, it seemed like it was quite light in a way, the book, and there was a lot of space in it, I felt. And then when I get into Ted Bundy and this whole machinery of serial killers, I just felt that, oh, God, this is such a heavy, and we're supposed to be nearing the end. So I'm just saying that as a, I mean, it doesn't necessarily lead to anything, but that was my impression when I was imagining people reading this book, as one does perhaps as an author, you know, when it's going to be released. So it's good to hear that you found it was vital and essential, because I didn't know that was going to be added in there. I really didn't. I thought I was finishing up, and the next thing I know, I'm looking into the deep background of Ted Bundy. Now, I've always been interested in serial killers. I mean, not literally, but almost literally always, like since I was 15 or something, I was reading Colin Wilson's The Criminal History of Mankind, and yeah, sort of brushing up on all the different serial killers. We don't have to go into that, but it's been a sustained interest throughout my life. Specifically, I mean, the way that serial killers were introduced into Big Mother, as I think I make clear, was simply an example. I wanted to show an example of how we have this mainstream narrative about something, and then we have maybe this second counter narrative about a conspiracy behind it, because my research indicates, and Dave McGowan say his research indicates, serial killers are simply not what the mainstream media has presented them. They're not working alone. They're part of networks that go back decades, and even generations. Like, there's a tradition of psychological warfare and domestic terrorism that goes like prehistorically, actually. But anyway, that's only the second layer. And I wanted to show that there's a third layer, which is that you can't actually explain serial killers with organized crime intelligence psyops either, because you have to go to, you know, what's behind it metaphysically, what's actually driving the people who are creating the serial killers. So that was all. I just wanted to give a really concrete example of that, but then it opened up all these other avenues, which obviously is what got your attention, including, well, what was the one you mentioned, Nosey? Because there's so many different angles.
It was the ratcheting up the sort of manufacturer consent
control.
I mean, they existed because of technological development. I mean, just even something like the motor car, for example, or the highway. And then in turn, because of their existence and because of the widespread attention of something like true crime culture, which is exploded on YouTube now, it creates that paranoia that then justifies the state, the Big Mother state, to keep surveilling and keep micromanaging.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was certainly, that's the second layer. And I was aware of that in my 20s, because Mae Brussel pointed this out. There was this Project Phoenix in Vietnam that was then imported to the US in terms of this terrorism tactics that serial killers function as a way to facilitate or justify more draconian state control measures. There's a whole other, sort of mentally groping my way around this, but I mean, first of all, there's this whole other thing that I talk about in the book, which is that it's not just that serial killers are used to terrorize people, they're also used to create narratives to entertain people, and serial killers are romanticized. If you think of Silence of the Lambs, I wrote about that book, that film, as a film critic, my first book, Blood Poets, because I was horrified when I saw it. I don't know about horrified, but I was disgusted. That at the end, when Hannibal Lecter makes that joke, I'm going to have a friend for dinner, because he's stalking the psychiatrist and he's going to eat him, and he's free, he's on the loose, this predatory psychopath. The audience laughs and claps, and I was just kind of gobsmacked by that. Why is this audience so delighted that this psychopath is on the streets and about to eat somebody? Okay, you don't like the character, but he's going to eat. But to me, it brought home something to me that there's something in us that does actually admire these individuals who act out our very worst instincts. And it's inseparable from demonizing. We can demonize them and then scapegoat them, but at the same time, we're having our cake and eating it. We're also romanticizing them and getting to live out our fantasies without ever admitting that actually we do want to be like that. And what's left, in some way, we want to have that freedom to just do what we want, right? Be free of the oppression of morality and all the rest of it.
Well, this was something that you put in the book that I didn't know about, and I'm by no means a Randian, but Rand, borrowing from Nietzsche, the idea of the Superman, the sort of totally self-legislating individual who makes his selfishness a virtue, she drew upon a serial killer as an example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's okay. I really don't want to follow that philosophy then, if you think the logic does follow that if you make total independence and autonomy, the end state of humanity, and you use technology to facilitate that, then you become a kind of person who believes they're entitled to do anything up until the point of ending another life.
The Havelock Ellis thing comes to mind as well, which Havelock Ellis was a sexologist, a precursor of Kinsey. And his perspective, as I quote in the book, was that the most dramatic or the most essential expression of human freedom was sexual perversion. So that's very similar to Ayn Rand's view that a free individual would go around killing people because they were completely unencumbered by any kind of moral criteria that was coming from outside, and they simply did not care what other people thought. They're sort of complementary, like sexual perversion isn't necessarily pathological or predatory or psychopathic, but
they're often intertwined, especially with serial killers.
Well, they certainly are intertwined.
And the interesting thing is, it's very intertwined with your conception of a big mother Oedipal state, because that's a very Freudian idea, in that the ability to liberate yourself is to liberate yourself not just from overt fascistic impositions of power on your will, but internalized, repressed, unconscious impositions on your will. And Freud obviously believed that the sexual impulse is one of the things that's most repressed. So if you abolish all the repressions on your sexual impulse, you're totally free, right? Shouldn't the big mother state try and enable you to do that?
Mm.
Yeah, so they're all very intertwined, I think.
Yeah, well, and that's in the early leftist movements. Again, this is more in Vice of Kings, but the Kinderladen in Germany was one of the things I wrote about. These were these kiddie nurseries, or whatever we call them here, nursery schools, where they wanted to sexualize the children, because precisely for this reason, they thought if you liberate children from sexual oppression, if you liberate them sexually, they will be immune to any other kinds of psychological control.
Was that the Kentler experiments as well? There was post-World War II. We've covered this on the website before. There was a psychologist called Kentler who knowingly put foster children with convicted paedophiles because they believed that if they liberated them from sexual oppression, Nazism would never happen again.
Yeah.
It's just like mental and evil, but it tracks with the logic of repression is going to cause violence, therefore we abolish all repression.
Yeah, no, it sounds like the same thing in the same period, I think. And I think, I mean, there's something I think we could get to that would be helpful here in terms of really zeroing in on the larger picture and technology as well. It has to do with a lack of a spiritual dimension. When the spiritual dimension isn't allowed for an understanding of the human being, then something else enters in there. Like, so what is a human being like if he's completely free to be what he is? If you don't allow for some spiritual approach to that, which, you know, I want to sort of bookmark that because it's a whole subject unto itself. And spiritual freedom has to do really with service to something greater. But that's obviously, that's a whole big subject. But it's certainly not freedom just to indulge your desires, I think is probably a way to simplify. So if you don't allow that, then what does freedom, what does it look like, or what are the criteria? This whole other criteria enter into it, which in many ways they do come down to just to freedom to indulge your desires. And we can see that as above, so below. I mean, you can look at the elite if you want, you can try to, because you can't get behind closed door, but you can speculate about the elite. Or you can look at somebody like Jimmy Savile, and he even talked in interviews about having total freedom and the responsibility of having total freedom. Now we know what he was talking about, right? Total freedom is freedom from all moral criteria to do whatever the hell you want, no matter the consequences to others. So we've got some sense of this predatorial elite who don't have the same checks and bounds as the rest of us, but we are seeing it trickle down now more and more into the everyman culture, where there's this propagation of sex without consequences and anything else without consequences, do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law, bloody blah. And where that leads, I guess, is what we're talking about. But I think we would have to get there, but to maybe unpack what I'm going to say. But it seems to me that that technology is central to this. That technology has to do, again, it's filling the void where normally the divine would be in nature, and just connecting to nature and finding our place in nature. Technology is all about augmenting the possibilities of human beings, like literally and figuratively in all these other ways. But it's also giving our power to something else that has its own agenda. We're discovering. So this is, I mean, I think I'm coming back to the question you asked that I never answered, like what's behind Big Mother? Yeah, there's some void there that we don't know how to fill, because as you said, well, the crypto matriarchy is a means, it's not an end, it's a means to something else. And this, just as, you know, previous forms of totalitarianism were also means. But it's, I think it's becoming more and more obvious that this fact, all of this stuff that we're looking at that's wrong with society, we're thinking, oh my God, we're ending up in this place. In a certain sense, we are. But on the other hand, no, we're on our way to something else. And this is the means to it. It's the post-human, post-gender, right, state. But what is that? Like, what's post-human? It's not divine. It's not Jesus, right? It's not a man or a woman who's just in service to nature and in harmony. No, it's something that supposedly, like Havelock Ellis and Ayn Rand were trying to propagate. It's something that it doesn't transcend those things. It defies them and it opposes them in a pathological way. I think you can oppose things in a way that is, you know, it's collaborative and it's productive, but this is not. I can't even find the verb for it, but it's actually just, it's like trying to destroy them, really.
Yeah, well, it cedes the power of something that is beyond itself to itself, and that is an ultimately self-destructive thing. Because if you try and fill a vessel with too much, it will overflow and flood. So if the human being tries to take on the power of godhood, well, it's a fallacy. They're just imitating godhood under the promise of something else that is the enemy to human nature. This is, I spoke to a Catholic writer who wrote Genesis of Gender, Abigail Favale, and one of her primary definitions of whatever the satanic will lurking behind a lot of the post-gender ideas were, was Satan is the enemy of human nature. And something akin to the abolition of human nature is the promise originally from the Garden of Eden. Again, we can engage in metaphors here, audience, if you want. Yeah. Christians, eat of the fruit and you should be as gods. Well, it was a false promise. It was conceit. But the idea was that if to be as a god is to re-legislate morality or abolish it totally, as you've been hitting on. I think maybe then to lead into the technology as demonology broader question, it might be useful to go down the gender route, because that's a great example of that transitional stage that you were talking about, of the matriarchal big mother state isn't the end goal. It's just what's bringing into being something else. Because this is a conversation I had with Helen Joyce a little while ago, and that is that she believes that, much like the people think that we live in a gynocracy and it's going to be the forever totalitarian state, she believed that transgenderism is a retranslation of patriarchy. And it's like, well, no, it's just the bus station on the way to the abolition of gender entirely, the making of sex as a cosmetic individual option, the idea that we can re-legislate our own forms. So I just found that your inclusion of that in the book very elucidating, and it wasn't a way that quite a few people, I think about that issue. That's actually probably a better way to take it then. What brought you to bring transgenderism into the book that up until that point had been mainly about tech?
Well, in terms of how I brought it in, I mean, it's probably not so interesting because in the mechanics of how books assembled, right, they're only interesting to other writers. But obviously, and actually a lot of that material I'd already written before Big Mother, but including the early material as well. So Big Mother was cobbling together various things, but they did fit. And the obvious way in which transgender is an example, well, it's an example, obviously, of two things. One is the male's possession by an invisible female presence, probably the mother, right? As in men who think they're women. I'm like, what is this gender identity that's saying, let me out, cut my balls off so I can be who I am? What is that? You know, it's easy to say it's a demon, but you don't get very far. Like, you've got to explain that, or some discarnate entity, let's say, really like the D word too much. But it's also perhaps too easy to say, well, that's a mother complex, particularly in a post-Freud age where Freud's been, tossed out with the bathwater of bad psychology. Where was I going with this? So it's definitely an example of what looks like a male. I know it goes the other way too, but I'm focusing on what's more common and more prevalent in society, which is men who either think that they're women or simply want to try out being a woman for a number of different reasons that, you know, we could get into, but we don't need to. What's behind that? And then the other thing is the technology. You need tech. Not only do you need technology to change sex, and I had to put the quotes because nobody can change sex. And this is what, for those who don't know, this is why the word gender that belonged in the realm of language, as in linguistics, was transported to the realm of biology where it has absolutely no place whatsoever. It doesn't refer to anything because there is no non-biological sex. Sex is a biological thing. So it's about an identity. I forgot what I was saying there.
Well, technology is the legitimating force by which that gender imposition is brought into being.
That's right. So it was John Money and the Hopkins that introduced the word gender because they realized that transsexuals could never change sex. So no matter how much money they paid or how much tech was brought to the problem, they wouldn't ever actually change sex. They might change their genitals, but even that's not true because they get rid of real genitals and replace them with fake genitals. Sorry,
it's just a facsimile. One of the ways that you put it is it's transhumanism is a false religion because it tries to make human beings pass their own Turing test.
Yeah.
And essentially so. Like we're ratcheting up tech until we can just lie ourselves into a new state of being.
Yeah.
And transgenderism is just one very prominent avenue, probably because sex and sexuality is the most foundational building block of being human.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's become the most powerful force to push that agenda forward.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I was getting to was that it's not just that the individuals who have body dysphoria or sex dysphoria who want to change sex, that they need technology to do it, but that they actually become kind of technologized beings. Their bodies become part technology, really. And that, so that's like a carrier wave, if that's the right term, for this ideology, which itself is carrying in something else that's only using the ideology. And I think we could see this, improvising now. I don't know exactly what I'm going to say, but we could say very clearly and emphatically that the transgender ideology is its aim is to turn human bodies into technology, let's say, or to, you know, make them mix them with technology, and that does massive amount of harm to human bodies. So that's irrefutable. You know, they get sterilized, they don't have orgasms, they just don't function properly sexually as human beings. But what's not so, well, it is equally obvious, but maybe they need to be put together, is cognitively the damage it's doing to not just individuals who identify with the opposite sex or have body dysphoria and are accepting these pseudo solutions, but obviously relatives, family members, friends who are going on with it, but all the rest of us who, even if we don't go along with the pronouns, we're still having the language hijacked. Like it's, you know, I've been, I won't go into the details, but recently I've just been experiencing, like, I see somebody's pronouns and they're saying his, her, him, but it's obviously a guy. It's like, what do those pronouns mean now that a guy is actually saying that they're a guy? Cause they're not, they're just doing it for these other people. So it's as if him, his, he, it no longer means the same thing, Summer. Just as a woman, if you take on this programming, no longer means the same thing, because a woman now is supposed to mean anyone who says they're a woman. Therefore, it doesn't mean anything. So there's kind of insidious co-opting of the language.
You're buying into the prospect of dislocation, even if you aren't participating in it.
Yeah, so you're, by uncoupling yourself from... in a way, your own cognition, but it's really more about your own felt sense of what's real, that you don't really even need cognition to know you've got a cock and balls and that you're a guy and that you get, you know, these things are just like animals have them. So, and animals don't have cognition the way, so you don't even need cognition, but cognition certainly, you know, hooked into that. And if you hack into the cognition and start rewiring, like 2 + 2 = 5, that does have a trickle down effect with your relationship with your body. Of course, you just get more confused and ashamed and all these things. But anyway, the end game seems to be, to turn as many human bodies into carriers of the language and the ideology that itself is a carrier for this X factor, this thing that's trying. Well, it's an invasion. I mean, we might as well call a spade, even though it is risky if you cut right to the chase, because we have to rewind again and fill it in again. But one I have of to the, end somewhere, right?
One of the ways to explain it again, whether it's metaphorical or literal, still up in the air. There was one of the Vatican's chief exorcists once wrote about demonic possession, and he said that if you continually consume vice and you don't have a steady sense of self, you become a vessel for some other entity. And obviously he literally believed there's demons. You could say ideological possession or a kind of insecurity that accelerates the force of entropy on your civilization. There is something that's going to animate you if you don't have a fixed psychology and a sense of embodiment. If you aren't sure in yourself, then some idea will possess you that is a contaminant to the rest of civilization.
Yeah.
Obviously, some of the thinkers you cited in this, like Alul and McLuhan, and you said you weren't familiar with Schmitt's work, but he's actually very parallel to this, did think that there's some sort of demon in the wires. But the effect is very much the same. Even if you're just saying you're personifying whatever will is destroying human nature through technology, then there is still something enacting here that we want to avoid.
Yeah.
And we're moving in service of that, it definitely feels like.
Yeah. Yeah, so as we were saying before, into like demon, the word demon, or at least the word entity, non-human force, it is helpful and even necessary to create enough space to recognize that there's something that is not in anybody's interest. Like it's not enough to just to try and point the finger at social engineers or ruling classes or conspiracy agents. So, I mean, because David Icke, you know, he goes to the reptilians and it doesn't work. This is partly why I'm hesitant. If you're going to name the thing as a placekeeper so that we can introduce this idea, then, as I said, then you need to back up and just start filling, okay, what are we talking about and why are we talking about it? One of the reasons why I think we need to talk about it is that, I don't know about the first casualty, but maybe the most important casualty of this kind of takeover that we're looking at, as we talked about with transgender, is the abolition of objective reality, of the idea of it. Obviously, you can't get rid of objective reality because that's what makes it objective. But because there's more and more sophisticated recognition that by its own definition, objective reality can't be subjectively experienced, there's a sort of collective mutual decision, or we'll just forget about it then. If you can't experience it, who cares, right? It doesn't matter. So then the subjective reality gets reified, and then everything is subjective reality, and then everything's fair game. I mean, you define your own reality and you say what you think is true and nobody can say no. So that's a problem. I mean, I think it's self-explanatory that that's a problem, but also you can just look around.
Can I pick up on why that's a problem? It's because objective reality faces no consequences if we ignore it. All the consequences are on us. And so if we're under the collective delusion that we can cut against reality, then all of humanity is going to run aground on its rocks eventually. And you're right. And this is the best way of saying it. You can use demon as a placeholder for whatever disembodied force seems to be pushing us towards that which is not in our interests. And going against human nature isn't in our interest, no matter how much you try and kitbash it together with tech to try and delude yourself into thinking that's the case. You're just going to drive yourself towards extinction in that way. It's like engendering your own obsolescence. As soon as you outsource your humanity to a machine and the machine breaks and no one remembers how to fix it, then what do we do? So yeah, that's why objective reality is the anchor point that we need to stick towards, because otherwise if we ignore it, then we just drift off into space, never to be seen again. But reality itself stays.
Yeah. So this is where the G word, God, does also become a necessary placekeeper. And certainly if you're going to talk about demons, you're going to talk about Satan, they've got a boss, you're going to talk about Satan, okay, and well, now we're on to God. And there is a correlation that I've been making in my own mind, but also for others, that between Nietzsche's God is Dead and the abolition of objective reality. It's even in Nietzsche, I think. I haven't read him for a long time, but I'm sure that it's in there. He's saying, you know, once you kill God, you know, problems, they mount exponentially. So, yeah, I mean, at the risk of repeating, I mean, it's a very essential thing, so it maybe is worth repeating what you said, but it's what I was getting to, too, that we need a compass, whether it's God or objective reality or both, we make them synonyms, to orientate ourselves in terms of how we live our lives and how we relate to our bodies and to others, that there are consequences. Whether you say it's God, you know, the wrath of God and divine justice, or whether you just say, well, it's objective reality, and if I miss the nail and hit my thumb, it's going to hurt. I can't just will, you know, use will or law of attraction or postmodernism or whatever to say that, you know, or quantum physics, that the thumb doesn't really exist. It's just energy. There are these consequences, but the more we rely on technology, this is the Garden of Eden, and it's a different promise explicitly, but I'm sure we could map them together. The promise of technology, well, you shall be as gods, obviously, is that you don't have to face the consequences, that it provides this buffer between us and objective reality, which the closest we've got to that is nature, you know, red in tooth and claw, right? But other things too. It's not only you know, dangerous and violent nature, but it certainly is. It doesn't compromise with you. You can't like negotiate with nature and say, please let this fight. Well, you can pray, of course, but that's something else. But, essentially you have, I mean, before you start praying, you have to do due diligence that you are, facing reality, but I mean, you are,
you're in an insurmountable proximate distance to something that you can't ever hope to displace. Like, you have to recognize the hierarchical power of God in order to petition him, right? And this is something that connects to, and you said that you hadn't, you didn't put Heidegger in here, but you said that you hadn't really come across this concept of capital B being. But this is something that you said almost that the soul has a communal aspect in that it interfaces with objective reality. The soul is connected to other souls and nature. And if you disconnect the soul from objective reality by pretending that it's not there, then you alienate yourself from the world and you alienate yourself from others. And then the absence of that soul lets you act in the will of something else. So taking God out of that equation puts us under the delusion that we're in a mechanistic universe that can be Prometheanly re-engineered to fit our own will. But of course it's not necessarily our own will, it's a will of something that is antagonistic to us. We just don't realize we're in the transitional stage yet.
So that saying, the devil makes work for idle hands, the sort of the flip side of that is that the devil's work is to make us as idle as possible. And I think that's what I'm seeing recently, or becoming more aware of, is that people are very lazy about these things. That they're not as complimentary as, I mean, we can. The flip side of this is that people get hysterical about things that should not matter, like which pronoun you use. I mean, whatever. Let's not go back into that. But on the other hand, they're very lazy about questioning, you know, what's going on, and that. So there's an engineered complicity, which essentially is, it's built around, again, this offer of convenience and comfort and lack of consequences and the temptation of that. When you think of Jesus in the desert, what did the devil say? You're hungry? Turn those stones into bread, right? If it was now, it'd be like, we've got this technology or this 3D printer. You can print up a falafel, you know, just tap the keys, right? And most of us have been, again, we could bring it back to Big Mother now. If you've been mollycoddled your whole life, where you don't have the tolerance to just go hungry or be cold or suffer discomfort, then, of course, you're prime game for these temptations. You wouldn't last 40 minutes, never mind 40 days in the wilderness. You just, as soon as the devil shows up, you just give me my smartphone, right?
That's a very similar observation to what Schmidt made in the concept of the political and Roman Catholicism, the political form. Again, I feel like you're running in parallel tracks. He would criticize things like liberal individualism, technology, the idea of capital P progress, that they were on that weak history arc towards things that can only ever get better. Tony Blair phrase, right? The idea is that banality blinds us to the emergence of an existential threat that he literally said is not of this world. Similar to McLuhan, what you put in your epigraph, he said the modern city is the hub of electrification. We're obsessed with electrification. This is what Lenin was obsessed with. So is the modern liberal world. We're just negotiating the means, but we're headed in the same direction, which is the manifestation of a kind of hell. And we're committed to that because we're so wedded to things that we think are good, like endless material prosperity, the idea of generating abundance, the idea of never going uncomfortable or hungry or cold, that it keeps us looking that direction while something akin to the Antichrist is coming over our shoulder and wants us to go in that direction. And I think you're bang on right in that not only do we maybe need to introduce on a microcosm little bits of discomfort in our own lives to give ourselves a bit of a reality check, but you do need to unplug quite a bit more, because otherwise you might not realize you're acting in the service of whatever this anti-human will is, but you're going to inevitably if you get too reliant on the machine.
Yeah. I mean, some of that is fairly obvious, I suppose, and certainly if we translate it into literal action, Don't be so reliant on a state that you know doesn't have your interests at heart, and become more self-sufficient. Those things are obvious, even if people don't do anything about it. But what occurred to me while you were speaking, and this is in Big Mother 2, is towards the end, and it's only a paragraph or so, but there's, because the way the Antichrist, we're going to name that, the way it works, the way it proceeds is nothing if not insidious. And it will use our best qualities against us, as I'm saying. Maybe this is similar to what I was saying earlier about the difference between a big brother and big mother, I'm not sure. But it's not going to obviously say, oh, you can have lots of sex and money and power, right? Because we know, there is some good in culture, and there's some residue of religious thought. We do have a sense of, oh, we're being tricked now if it's too obvious. So there's much more insidious ways, and essentially it will play on what we think of as virtue, but it will create counterfeit virtues. And then sell those to us. And because we've got this whole thing of virtue signaling now, is very obvious. But what was occurring to me while you were talking was that a thing that we need to unplug from, which is not recognized and it's very hard to talk about, is our false compassion for others, for humanity, this idea of humanity. Because that is used against us. That is a way to trick and trap us into remaining in ways of behavior and remaining reliant on systems of care and all that stuff, which we know are corrupt, actually.
Well, that's a consequence of technology as well, because people never used to think at that level of resolution before. No. The concentration of cities or the emergence of social media or the telephone or mass media, people just used to think, what's the immediate concerns of my family, my household, my community?
Exactly.
We've upscaled to the point now of where we're being driven mad by thinking of too many people in our remit of moral consideration.
I would agree. I think it is driving people mad. I mean, we're certainly seeing that people are being driven mad, but it's not, I don't think of this factor as being identified very much. And I think it's a good one to zero in on, because I think it's good to find things that feel almost unsayable, right? That actually maybe we shouldn't care about humanity. Maybe we shouldn't have this idea that we're part of this human species thing. Because if it's not based on direct experience, like I haven't met these 8 billion people. I don't even know for a fact that they exist. I do know there's nothing I can do to help them, even if I knew what would help them. Right. And then there's a whole deeper criteria for that, which we're touching on, which is what helps a soul doesn't necessarily help someone's lifestyle and vice versa. So there's all these layers whereby if we look at that, we've been trained and conditioned to have this pseudo compassionate response for what's going on in the world. Even you talked about before we were talking, like, how many people can get woken up so they will escape hell. And like, it's not our concern, or it doesn't need to be. And at least if we're not actually doing it for ourselves yet, this tendency or this temptation to worry about others when we haven't actually sorted out our own thing, clearly that's detrimental. It potentially, and I think very actually, prevents us from focusing on absolutely what we can, I don't want to say change, but what we can experience and do something with, not necessarily about, because maybe it's not about changing or fixing anything, but certainly just, maybe this comes back to observing the law of matter and just being physically present. Every encounter we have, there's a potential for some sort of meaningful exchange. Community, such as it is, like human community, clearly it's not the global village. That's exactly what we're talking about. It can't be through technology. If we only know about all these other souls, quote, all these bodies through technology, well, maybe it's better not to know about them. Right? So then you and I are in the room. This is where it's happening, or wherever we go. Human community is only going to come out of Like I ran a thrift store with my wife in Canada during the COVID years before I came to Spain. And that was a crash course for me. Like I had to interact with hundreds of human beings I would never normally have interacted with and never wanted to interact with. I mean, some really damaged people and difficult people and unpleasant people. It was grueling, but it was character building. And it was putting my money where my mouth was, even though I wasn't talking about community before that, but it gave me, then I was able to talk about it. Human community is very difficult, needless to say.
There's a strain of sort of Petersonian thought in there of where you need to order your own bedroom before you go about cleaning out the world. This is one of the things that they always tell you when you board an airplane, is that fix your own oxygen mask before you try and fix the other person's, because there's no use trying to help someone if you yourself are going to pass out in a split second.
Exactly,
and one of the best examples of this as well, which is a spirit of technicity solution to an apocalyptic problem that I think is conceited, is the climate change one. I mean, you can't get higher resolution. The entire planet is going to burn because of human activity. So what we need is collective, global, top-down delivered human activity to try and control the whole globe. This is something that I think McLuhan and Hannah Arendt both warned about at the same time. And that is, once you expand your remit of consideration to the whole world, once you try and engineer the atmosphere itself with technology, once you stick satellites into space, you turn the eye of Big Brother, or in this case, Big Mother, inwards. The entire world becomes an enclosed surveillance state to be engineered. And so if you're engineering the human environment, again, you're alienating the souls from it, and you're alienated from each other, because now, yes, we know about all these people. We know about the 8 billion people around the world. We know about their suffering, but only through the digital intermediary. We're not physically meeting them. Our souls are not connected to them by proximity. We're trying to talk to them via the demon in the wires. That's what's driving people mad, is because we're alienating ourselves from our atmosphere and each other in the service of what? Well, clearly not the human experience, because nobody's happy.
Yeah, but another clue to this is that the visible social engineers, and Bill Gates pop into mind, but whoever, it doesn't matter. But I mean, because the visible ones are probably less influential, powerful than the invisible ones, but at least you can, you know, hear what they say. And one of the main things they're saying, Apple Mac is big on this, is, let's make the world a better place. I mean, that's pretty much their mantra, right? For implementing the most malevolent agendas, of course. I mean, what else is the devil going to say? You know, I'm here to help you, right? Or Fauci.
Well, Google's motto used to be don't do evil, yeah, and then they took it away.
Yeah, well,
very telling.
I don't know what that was about. Yeah, maybe they got a memo from God or something. Make the world a better place, care about humanity. The fact is that these values, or these, what's the word for them, executive agendas, but these criteria that are being sold to us, they're being sold to us by the very agencies and institutions that we know are doing evil. So there's a big clue in that. A, that they use them themselves as cover for dastardly deeds, but B, that they are trying to push them on us. There's got to be some sort of clue in that. It can't be for our good. Now, any kind of universal value, this is we're going to be a very broad statement, but maybe it's about objective reality again, potentially, that any kind of universal value that comes from the outside, and in a way, that's supposed to be its credential, that it's universal, or it's coming from the outside because it's universal, or vice versa. You know, everybody knows that humanity is all in it together, and we all need to look out for each other, blah, blah, blah. They're not doing it. But that universal value is coming from the outside. It's untested, right? It's actually worthless unless it allows for some sort of insight and some sort of testing and experimental practical thing where you go, aha, well, actually that is true and I've confirmed it. But then you still throw out the external value because now you found the internal sense. I do happen to believe that we are all connected human beings, at a deep energetic level, like you're saying about souls, and that's the true humanity, is this human energy field, which is, you know, it's just tricky to put words on it. Maybe it's not energy, maybe it's spirit, but I do believe there's a truth behind that. However, what I don't know, and I've talked about this in the past, but it's, again, it's a dangerous idea. I don't know that that corresponds with 8 billion bodies. If there are 8 billion bodies, first of all, I don't know that. Because I haven't counted them, right? And statistics obviously can be manipulated, but let's say that there are. I don't know that those bodies correspond with soul or sentience or what is truly objectively human. I just don't. Mm. I don't want to then extend that to say what they might be, right? We've got the NPC thing now, right? We've got these ideas that themselves are dangerous, but the point is, you don't have to go, you just stop at I don't know.
Yes, you have humility, but I think this is part of the sort of Promethean spirit of technology. It takes that humility away. It allows us to delude ourselves into thinking that we can actually be the architects of utopia on Earth rather than hell on Earth, which seems to be materializing, because it mechanizes the world and it takes that distance that you have from God to petition him in prayer, or at least the higher order values that you're meant to be accountable to, if, again, God is just a placeholder for some people. It takes that away. And so that's why you get into the rut of serving something that doesn't seem to be serving actually your own interests eventually. So my question is, obviously, without the Chinese EMPing us back to the Stone Age, and without technology being shut off overnight, what can people do to at least insulate themselves and the people that they immediately care about, if it is truly impossible to have that level of resolution where you try and save everyone, that kind of thing that will just drive you mad?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because you can't even save your family members, as we saw in the last couple of years. If they want to take some experimental nanotech into their bodies, not necessarily all the information in the world is not going to save them from that choice. So that's on a very small scale. And as far as you see, I mean, I was saying sort of, I was inferring that I need to question even the idea of trying to change anything or the idea of helping somebody. There's quite a bit of assumption in that and potentially arrogance. And I said to somebody recently that, who's also, it's Luke Dodson, I'll name drop him, he has the Dodcast. So he does a lot of good research on things like Extinction Rebellion and the Great Reset, all these kinds of things, and environmentalism. But anyway, I was saying to him, you know, if you're going to look at, there's something baked into the idea, it's on Wikipedia, of conspiracy theory, that those who research conspiracies, disapprove of what they're finding, that there's this element of disapproval. And I said, well, I don't include that, or I try not to, because what possible difference could my approval or disapproval of Bill Gates make to anything, right? How does that help if I'm going to disapprove? I'm not saying one shouldn't have a moral evaluation, but it's not necessarily the same.
But he doesn't care what you think, and it's not going to dissuade him from implementing his agenda.
No, and if I'm trying to talk to others about it, having a moral conviction that it's wrong isn't necessarily going to help my argument, particularly if they're on the side of Bill Gates. Right? So it is good to at least assume a sort of impartiality. But my point about that was that if you really strip it down, if I do, I'm only trying to alert people to the dangers of all this so I can have better conversations with them, right? It really just comes down to that. Because if I'm sitting with somebody and they're spouting all this bullshit that they've been, you know, that's been fed to them by the mass media, it's galling. And I start wanting to vomit or just leave the room. So I'm not saying this happens a lot, but that's the extreme.
Again, having done a fair few TV panel debates with the sort of Blairite boomers, it feels like TV static going through your mind. I mean, for me it's a kind of existential question of there's a feeling of obligation. If you are really a soul, capital B, being in the world, and you're interconnected to people, and you can't ever be severed from them. I mean, this is part of why the Big Mother State's so powerful, right? You can never not be your mother's son. So it's difficult to disconnect from that influence if it is ever smothering. I to it would feel like an abnegation of responsibility not to alert people to the kind of dangers of modernity and give them a chance to achieve escape velocity, hopefully, you know, with me, if I can manage to do it. That's why our platform exists. That's why hopefully people pay us to stay tuned. And I think hopefully that is the spirit of the book, whether or not you're optimistic about it being a possibility.
Well, I mean, I'm being maybe coy or something, but I'm being careful anyway. But, you know, my hope is to save souls by providing them with an experience, like a communication of experience, because it's not informational, I think. Like I was saying about the mRNA, people now, it's evident, they're immune to information. And with reason, I mean, there's been a policy of information overload. Like at a certain point, it was seen, we can't keep all this information to ourselves, so let's just flood the whole thing, and it's kind of the same result. Like anyone can just counter with, yeah, well, that's your source, I've got my source now, because, right? So what was I saying about this? That, oh yeah, so the Big Mother, I don't think of it as a body of information, I think of it as an argument, and behind the argument is a felt experience. That's why it's a shame I didn't include my mother in there, because it grounds it more, like, hey, I'm just one of these, you know, reformed mother boys who's trying to get free of these pathological programs. I mean, I was also assuming knowledge, because people who've read my previous books would already know it. So the point being, yeah, that if I can testify clearly and honestly, fearlessly, to my sense of hell, that's a bit Jordan Peterson-ish, isn't it? But
there's a reason he resonates.
And my sense of God and my sense of the body, and what has value, goodness, let's simplify it all, and we can even leave hell out of it, because, you know, hell is good for having a sense of goodness, right? The more viscerally we become aware of evil or of adverse conditions that we've created and chosen to be in, the more we can orientate away from them towards the goodness. So the more I can testify to real goodness, including, you know, good writing, try to write a good book, because it's not easy either, and it's a very ambitious book, but that's just the first layer. It's got to be a good book to communicate, but then what's being communicated is my trajectory in life towards goodness. Then potentially, even if one other soul is able to follow that thread to their own connection, then yeah, not mission accomplished, because there's many more, but it was effective and it was worth it. So that's the counterpoint, like I was saying. But to me, like with the thrift store, we were very helpful in the community. We would give we would give food to the homeless and hungry. We'd give away clothes. We gave a lot to the community. But all of that was baked into how to run a business correctly within the community, because we were dependent on donations. So it wasn't based on a value set of humanitarianism, much less communism, right, or socialism. And it wasn't based on this is the idea of this is the right thing to do. It simply was the right thing to do, because when you're running a thrift store and people come in and they got no money and they're cold, obviously you give them a blanket, particularly when you're getting more blankets than you need, right? It's just so natural. And so that was a great opportunity to actually, most people don't have that. I mean, being in London, my God, just for a week, it really driving home how people have become dehumanized by the concentration of population, right? And it's inevitable. I mean, just like simple example, I can't, even if I'm dying for a piss, I can't go into a cafe and say, can I use your toilet? Because no, you're not a customer. That's the policy. And you know why they have that policy? Of course, because it's in a big population. They could get all kinds of riffraff coming in, but they won't budge from it. Because then it's like the whole thing might collapse.
There's right? An anti-human inflexibility. Yeah, I had completely the opposite experience in Japan. I just came back this last weekend, and there are vending machines on every corner. There's no public bins, but there's no litter. It's because people take it home with them. even the people who are staffing the 24-hour 7-Elevens and the convenience stores, which isn't the most glamorous job in the world, considerate, polite, they actually care about the service they're providing. All the toilets, they're immaculate, they're open for public use in pretty much every establishment, and it's because you haven't got a hyper-concentrated population of strangers all on top of each other, living at a million miles an hour, in service of generating prosperity for whatever trickle-up technical spirit wants us to, you know? So, yeah, it's about, I suppose, about disconnecting as much as we can from the alienating high pace of modern living.
Yeah, and that's, again, that's sort of obvious, but it's not if you live in London, right?
Yeah.
Because you just get used to the opposite. But that there's also, there's also an ideology behind that that is not so obvious that people need to disconnect from, where they don't realize that it's anti-human. They think they're part of something that is meaningful. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get it back to the unfinished point. It was about how we can actually really be of service to one another and what real community looks like. First of all, we need to push out the counterfeit idea of what it is, of what it is to help somebody. And I do think it's not as obvious as we think. Like, spreading information doesn't necessarily help people. Persuading people by argumentation doesn't necessarily help people. There's got to be something more. Got to be something simpler, actually, but harder to talk about, which is we have to embody something. We have to actually embody a way, which sounds pretentious. You know, that's how gurus, you know, somebody ends up a guru because they say they're embodying a way. You don't say you're embodying a way, you embody the way. And then everything else is sort of, you know, icing on that cake. Obviously, the things you talk about, like, it's harder to embody truths that people don't want to hear because they're resisting you. Mm. And there's a tendency to compensate, overcompensate with conviction or moral outrage or preaching or platforming. Nothing wrong with preaching, actually, but, you know, soapboxing. However one does it wrong, there's a million ways to do it wrong, right? If you're actually trying to open people's awareness to something. The first thing that we all know, we're all aware of, but it doesn't usually make it to the mind, it is, what is that person embodying? Like, are they embodying the values? Like, how are they? How are they breathing? How do they smell? How are they, you know, their physical body language? That's all pre-rational, isn't it? Like, we actually do communicate at that level before the other level. Mm. And at the end of the day, I don't think we are influenced, maybe that's not the right word, but we can't serve each other except by through these hidden channels.
Mm. To connect it almost back to religious imagery then, there's two things there. The first is that in order to actually service humanity, we have to not think of it as a collective in service of humankind, in the same way that we have to get comfortable with the idea of obscurity or something beyond our capacity to know, that technology has meant that we've got the arrogance of thinking the whole world is knowable, because we don't actually know all those people. We don't know how the mind of God works, even if we wish to act as if we are gods. It's the this is something that Schmidt wrote again. The religious ritual is anathema to technology because they deliberately include something like incense to obscure, to remind you that you can never fully know, while also putting you in a sensory preparatory state in order to receive wisdom if you're humble enough to understand it. And I've just dropped my second point.
You've lost your thread, have you?
Yes.
Why don't I interrupt you and maybe it'll come back? But because assuming we're going to go on for a little bit longer, I could take a pee break.
Yeah, go for it.
Some more water.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we'll probably wrap up in the next 10 minutes, but I'm happy to do that.
Well, if you want to wrap up in the next 10 minutes, I'll just stick it out for sure.
I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. There was something really bloody...
Yeah, well, why don't I give you time? We're going to want to edit this out anyway.
Yeah, no worries. The gents is not... So
it's past the closed door. There's another closed door.
There's the door on the other side of the two lifts. Yeah. So not the door on the, not the door there. Yeah. There's a door there, and then there's a disabled loose and a gents loose.
Oh, now I didn't see it then.
Oh my god, my brain. It's really annoying. Shit. You're right, I did remember it.
Yeah.
There we go.
Very good. Give me a second.
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
That's it. Right. There we go. Yeah. Okay. And then the second point was, you're right in that I think there is only a limit, and it's perhaps part of the Promethean conceit to think that we can speak the world into being better as if we were God.
Mm.
You need to physically embody, capital B being, those virtues as a living example for other people. And on the flip side of that, there are some people that won't come along with truth, beauty, virtue until they increasingly see hell being made manifest. As you said, with this book, you're pointing out the animating principle that's behind it is fundamentally anti-human. Again, whether you want to call it a demon and you want to personify it and you want to believe it's truly possession or it's just a useful placeholder, I don't think there are some people that will be convinced verbally by other people until they see hell being enacted in their own lives. And this is something that comes back to the Schmittian critique of technology or progress as a neutral force. Until people realize that this force that has been sold to them as progressive, compassionate, the science, is actually making hell manifest on Earth, you won't get that bifurcation into the people that will run headlong into it because it lets them do as they will and all they care about is bodily pleasure and they want to be transhumanists, or the people that would actually like to live embedded, embodied in little communities that they know among people that they actually care about.
Mm.
And so maybe that is the true use of your book for the true believers that can understand it. It's understanding, no, we are seeing hell made manifest. Insulate yourself accordingly.
Mm. Yeah, because I don't offer solutions, at least not in the framework of progress.
Mm.
Like, they're not forward thinking solutions. They are, I don't know about unfortunately, but they are backward thinking solutions back to the basics. And so I'm hesitant to say that's a solution. It's more of a withdrawal. It's kind of in the last lines or very near the end anyway, where I say about the woke people in a weird way, they think they're at the head of the curve, and they are, but it's a curve to hell. And so those of us who are paying attention, they're canaries in the coal mine. Okay, we're actually on the brink of hell now. Let's back up. Seriously, let's back up. It's not worth sticking around to watch the spectacle. A, because it's not worth seeing. It's grisly and fascinating, and that's a trap in itself. But B, because if you're watching it, you're not creating enough distance. If you get far enough away, you won't be able to see it, just as if I continue on my own backward curve, back to the basics, back to nature, then eventually I won't be, I won't know what's going on in the world. But I will, because I know it's hell, right? It's just variations of the same thing. So, I mean, I've said this many times for many years. Like, I don't offer solutions, because, I mean, there's this axiom, or have you, Einstein said it, but Steiner said it. I prefer Steiner to Einstein, that if we try to solve a problem by using the same thinking that created the problem, it's not going to work. And it's just ridiculously naive, stupid, and even borderline insane to think it would. So, and another way of putting that is to say that you can't even begin to try and solve a problem until you've fully understood it. We're a million miles away from that. We're further from understanding the problem of, you know, human society and human health than we were 100 years ago. So so that, you know, face that fact. But the other angle to look at this, which is more optimistic, is that, I mean, we don't know. By definition, we haven't fully understood the problem. We don't know what it would be like if and when we did. But it is possible, and I think the psychotherapeutic process can be a model for this, that if we fully understand the problem, that is the solution. To actually fully see it, then it's, the metaphor of hell is perfect. If you map hell sufficiently, you find the exit. Bingo. As long as... I mean, the thing is, you have to move towards the exit. But generally speaking, as I'm saying about the problem, to find out where the exit is in hell, you've got to have a pretty thorough map. So by that time, you probably are convinced that hell is not a place you want to be. And so then you start orienting towards the exit. So the orientation, is away from, it's away from hell, but it's also away from these counterfeit virtues, which are, they have a root. Right, the root of all evil, which is supposedly love of money. I'm going to give a soundbite, test it out, and say that it's love of progress that's the root of all evil. This idea that we're supposed to be getting somewhere, maybe that's in the Garden of Eden as well. I mean, certainly knowledge of good and evil is somehow that makes you a god. Obviously, what knowledge of good and evil is preference. That's kind of the way I look at it. And it's weird, it's a bit contradictory, because we're talking about objective reality. You absolutely do have to have a sense of what's good and what's evil for yourself. But clearly that's not what the parable in Genesis is about, because that was a problem. The guy, and it led to shame and self-rejection in the myth, like they cover their genitals with fig leaves. So that, as with all counterfeits, there's the real thing, and the counterfeit looks a lot like it. So, yeah, there's good discernment, where you evaluate and you accept the consequences of certain forms of action, and you choose the good. You always choose the good. But I'm talking about the counterfeit, which is this knowledge of good and evil, which is all mental, and it's all, well, what do I like, you know? And what do I not, you know, what do I want? And that, what was I saying about that? That's preference. And I think that, you know, preference that's not based on, it's personal preference is not based on just orienting towards a higher will, you know? Not my will, but thy will be done. Like, you can't follow God's will if you have a personal preference. And in fact, the only way to follow it is to be willing to go completely against your personal preference, like back to Jesus in the desert. So, and I'm speculating now that all the progress and the whole idea of it, but also the reality of it, is to do with human beings pursuing their own preferences.
Mm. Mm. And you're not in the service of anything higher. Yeah. See, so what I'm reading of that is we've had prescriptions from types like Peter Hitchens that just say, England's lost flea. And the point is, this is illustrated actually in Revelation when they start listing the commodification of everything as the mark of the beast gets brought in and the Antichrist dominates the world until Christ returns. They list cattle, gold, etc. And the last thing in that list is human beings themselves.
Mm.
It's global commerce, global homogenization. You might flee elsewhere, but they will always come for you. And so you need to be aware of that fact, and you don't retreat into a pre-fall ignorance, an ignorance of good and evil. Instead, you take that knowledge, you embody it, and you follow the good in spite of knowing the evil that we were all capable of, and you expect evil to subsume other places for hell to be made manifest. But you always look for the exit. Mm. And if you know of the exit, then people might follow you out the door, hopefully.
Yeah, and there is a paradox in it. It's a Chinese finger trap of hell. Is that the way out of hell is to be okay being in hell because God put you there.
Hmm.
We put ourselves there, yes, individual responsibility, but if there's hell, there's a devil. If there's a devil, there's God. Therefore, there's a reason we're in hell. So therefore, we don't just try to get out. Back to the thing about the problem. How are you going to really know the nature of hell? Obviously by being in hell. But if you're spending your whole time in hell trying to pretend you're not in hell, or even trying to get out before you even figured out why you ended up there, you're not going to get out. Mm. Right? God's going to say, no, you still have to, more purification, or whatever we say. It's like a sauna, psychic sauna. And I've been thinking, like, are we going to get to somehow, it's not a solution, but it's a spin where we can turn everything on its head. And because there is an inherent contradiction in our being here with all this tech. There always is, because all of our media now is the internet, which is, you know, Iron Man's matrix, really. It's the way in which we're being lured into disembodiment, primarily is through the internet. And so here we are using the internet and all the technology to communicate this. So what are we, bodhisattvas? We're sacrificing our life force to Iron Man so that we can help others? Well, maybe that's an optimistic point of view, but or are we suckers who are falling, right? So then there's a temptation to rationalize and justify, as I just maybe did or gave one example of that. But there's also the possibility of somehow transcending that whole dichotomy, that we are, like I said, we're embedded in this for some purpose that does transcend our own personal preferences. It even transcends our need to physically survive, like the soul is on some sort of journey. Here we are. The thing is not to fall for the temptations or fall for the subterfuges and misidentify evil as good. But it doesn't necessarily mean being a Luddite. It doesn't necessarily mean, okay, I recognize that all this technology, whatever else we're talking about, is an instrument of evil and it's a means to an end. But I'm going to use it anyway. Well, this is the question. I don't know if I do have the end of that sentence.
It was a very meta question in that. Yeah. If the only way out seems to be through, particularly to raise people's consciousness of hell, at which point, and this is almost directed at me, at which point is my job done? At which point, you know, hello from hell, everyone. At which point do you renounce the technology and the attempt to raise consciousness and unplug yourself and go, okay, here's the exit to hell. Let's hope people follow with me.
Yeah. And in the meantime, what I was trying to get to is actually being comfortable in hell without the distraction. It's one thing to say, well, I'm in hell or I'm using all this technology, but I actually do like the hot dogs here, right? So I'm going to stay a bit longer. That's one thing. But another thing is to say, is to feel more and more like the oppression and the discomfort and the sacrifice that's being made by being in hell. But to always have one's eyes on the exit and to become more and more attuned that like God is omnipresent. Like he makes his bed in heaven, he makes his bed in hell. So we are connected to the divine even in hell. And actually that's the most valuable sense we can have, is that we have the lifeline. So actually then you're in hell, but you're also not in hell.
Yeah, not forever.
That's the lifeline. That's like Jesus going into hell after he was crucified.
Yes.
Because he's got his full connection. He can go as deep as he wants and he's still outside, but others are not. So how can he help those damned souls except by going to where they are? But it's okay. I mean, it is a sacrifice because it's extremely unpleasant, but there's no chance of getting lost in hell at that point.
Yeah. So don't be afraid of discomfort, because if the ultimate scapegoat could go through the ultimate pain and still make it out and be redeemed, then you can too.
Yeah.
That's very insightful. Yeah. Okay. Well, with that then, I suppose... That's plug the plug the for book. The book.
Yeah. Plug also my current endeavor. As I said, I think it's the last of that kind. So the question I had was, you know, what happens after mapping hell? And I didn't know if anything would. And it would have been fine if I wasn't doing anything more on the internet. But that didn't happen. So currently I'm fathoming God, as I put it. I'm writing about the Book of Job, a Substack. That particular book is my in. This whole thing, which I won't go into because we're winding up, but I just wanted to mention it. That's my focus currently, is trying to understand God, the placekeeper God, by referring to these old scriptures and making sense of them, you know, in our current mindset, which is not easy at all.
Yeah, well, all those links will be in the description for the audience to follow. And until next time, thank you very much for supporting all of our content. Goodbye.